Hello and welcome back to What is YA Anyway? I am, of course, Emma, your host. Today on the show, we have the number one New York Times bestselling author, Gail Forman. This was an absolute dream to talk to Gail. I have been such a huge fan of hers since I read If I Stay back when it came out in 2009, which I can't believe I am saying that. The book, if you're unfamiliar, went on to become a movie. It received a lot of critical acclaim. She has a bunch of other YA books, including Just One Day and Just One Year, as well as her recent YA novel, We Are Inevitable. She also writes middle grade and adult books. And this episode, we really dive into her writing process. She gives some advice for writers. She talks about why young adult books are important, what elements are important, what young adult books she loves to read, and really this is just all about the craft that goes into writing these books and the effect that they have both with the authors and with the readers. I'm so excited for you to listen, and without further ado, here it is. So I want to welcome you today to What is YA Anyway? And I'm here with Gail Forman. She is a number one New York Times bestselling author. And we're going to talk today about all things young adult literature, her books, a little bit about the future of YA, what she enjoys about it. And so let's dive into it. Gail, can you tell us a bit about yourself for our listeners?
Yeah. Hi, listeners. I'm excited to be here. My name is Gail Forman. I have been writing novels, mostly young adult novels, for I think 20 years now. And it's strange because it was never anything that I really saw myself doing, but I had been a journalist before and I had been obsessed with working at the magazine Sassy, rest in peace. And eventually Sassy had died, so I went to work for 17. But all my point being is, like, I've always been drawn to telling stories about and for young people. And early on, I realized that we have this strange generational thing where adults always, like, look over their shoulders and think, oh, young people, they're so silly, even though we all have had that. But I was blown away as a journalist and, again, as an author, the way that young adults will deeply engage in stories, in putting themselves in the shoes of other people. It's like they haven't corroded yet the way we sometimes do in adulthood. And so, you know, I write for all different age groups, but it's so gratifying. It's been so gratifying to kind of tell these stories. Even I always say that when I'm writing a YA novel, I'm usually writing about myself, but it always is these young people who are the sort of messengers I want to tell the story through.
That's amazing. And I follow up question to writing in that, how do you get into the headspace of writing in the young adult perspective?
You know, it's interesting because I have two teenagers myself now, and I do feel more than ever that there, you know, there is that generational difference. It's unavoidable. I admire them. I think that they are doing incredible thinking and questioning about assumed norms, but you don't get into it. It's just in you. I think if I had to kind of, like, quote, write in the voice of a teen, it would be terrible and cringy and all of that. There's just certain experiences. And I think for me, writing in the young adult voice is allowing myself to feel things as purely as I think you do when you are younger. And again, don't put all these sort of levels and layers between yourself and how you're actually feeling. It's much more pure and it's much more raw. And I think we have this idea that as we age, we shouldn't feel things that way. And I think it's actually untrue. I think we do. And I think a lot of the issues that people have are by not owning how they actually feel. So there's just something about the immediacy of emotion and feeling in writing young adult that when I tap into that, that's how I do the voice. And I think it's actually almost therapeutic for me to do that because it's a reminder not to hide behind feelings, but just to explore them.
And do you think that, so If I Stay and Just One Day and some of your other books are written in the first person perspective, does that really help you get closer to, like, expressing yourself in those books and making it, like, the immediacy that you talk about?
100%. It's interesting because my adult and my middle grade are third person. And even the YA that I'm working on right now, it's a mix between third person, but when it's the present tense, I think with I've Lost My Way, I did this where the flashbacks were in first person. There's something about not having that sort of distance between who's telling the story and who's in the story. So I absolutely agree. And even doing first person present tense, which when I wrote If I Stay, I didn't realize was like a no-no. That's not something you do. But I, again, it removes any of the distance. It's you and it's happening now.
Yeah. Was it difficult to toggle back and forth and If I Stay between Mia in her hospital state post-car accident and back when she was reflecting on times that she had had with her parents and Adam?
No, it was the most natural writing experience I've ever had. When I sat down to write If I Stay, I had written like a nonfiction book, a young adult book under my name and two under pseudonym. And my agent and my editor, they had all quit their jobs or left the industry. And so I was starting from scratch, it felt like. And I sat down to write this story and I had no sense of what I was going to do with it, only that I had to tell it. And I wrote the present tense part through the accident. And I was like, wow, I need a break from this. And I needed something happier. So that's when I wrote the flashback. And that's how that structure was born. And so it really was just kind of like, those flashbacks are such a relief of joy mm-hmm. and contrast to what she was going through. So I needed that as a writer. And it just happened to kind of be the structure. So that was one of those books where I didn't even think, I just kind of went. Mm-hmm. And I drafted that in 3 months and it wasn't very different from the book that was eventually published, which is unusual because mostly the other books have gone through, you know, massive changes during revision.
That's amazing. And I was reading the notes in the back. This is my edition here. And you have some author notes about how Mia came to you fully formed. Did that happen with, for example, Allison in Just One Day?
Allison, I had a dream about. So I had a dream that Allison was in this loft and having woken up from this like amazing night. And I woke up from that dream and I wanted to kind of figure out who she was and how she'd gotten there. And so that was where that came from. So she was kind of there and I knew that she was like this good girl who had done things that had been expected of her. But, you know, that it took a little bit longer to find her character and definitely Just One Day and Just One Year because they were so interwoven. It did not come out in 3 months, like the version that you see. But usually when I start a book, it's, you know, there's a character that's there that's very, very sort of, I won't say completely well-formed, but somebody who I already know. Sometimes they change along the way as I get to know them more. But it usually that's the sort of the catalyst is this character who arrives, not quite as fully formed as Mia. And I think with If I Stay, when I look back, one of the reasons it was such an easier book to write is unlike every other book I've written, Mia doesn't really have a transformation in the present tense. She doesn't have to, right? Like all this stuff is being thrown at her. She has a decision, but it's much more difficult when you are trying to have a realistic character transformation. The pacing of that becomes very, very tricky. So I think more to the point, I did know Allison, but the pacing of how she was going to get where she needed to be and who she was that day with Willem versus who she was back home and how she could kind of reconcile those two characters while also making sure that the two books fit together in this way where things that you read in Just One Day and you thought happened when you read it from Willem, you still saw that, oh my God, that I had that completely wrong because perspective changes everything, which I think is true in fiction as well as in life. Mm-hmm.
And when you're going to write any of your books, adult, young adult, middle grade, do you follow certain steps in a process or does it vary by book, by genre?
No, my writing process is pretty much the same. I usually have a pretty strong start and I know ish where I'm going in the end, but not exactly. And I wish that I could find a better way to do this, but it's a lot of like wrong turns and stuff that I write and throw away, partly because it's the process of getting to know a character. What made Mia different is that I knew her in my bones immediately. Yeah. And with other characters, it's like an actual relationship. It's like you spend more time with them and you're like, oh, that's why you're like that. Or, oh, that's what's driving you here. So I will draft mostly chronologically, and I will sort of back up during drafting if I sort of figure something out that needs changing. But I will draft and then I will revise on screen many, many times until something makes me not want to gag. And then I will print it out and do another go. And then I will repeat and do a read aloud. And this goes through many iterations before it even hits an editor, and it kind of repeats and repeats, but just lots of revision. I mean, every time you have distance from work, you see new changes and new things. And while none of my, all of my books are where I wanted them to be, I always feel like there's this chasm between, I call it the perfect song. Like in my head, I know what a perfect song is. And I don't know why all musicians don't always make perfect songs, but I know it's the same with the novel. I have this idea, and the act of writing it is closing the gap between your idealized version of it and the actual version, but you never get there. I mean, you'll hear authors talk about how when they are doing readings, they're editing as they go. Like you're always seeing things that you would change.
That's so funny that you talk about this, because I just taught a high school class creative writing, and we got to the end of our course and I was talking about revision, and I was like, revision is the most important thing you're going to do. I was like, you're never going to be done revising. Even when something is technically done, you're still going to be revising it. And they were like, oh, I don't really like revision. And I was like, I promise you will. I was
like, yeah, it's, I was just, I saw the author Holly Black yesterday, and she was talking about how like, she's so good at revision and she's not good at drafting. And I'm like, well, Holly, obviously you're good at drafting because you have something to revise. But I think when I tell young people about this, they just think like, they're thinking about like their high school assignment when their teachers makes them do multiple drafts. Mm-hmm. And it's the painful part of novel writing for, I think, most of us is the drafting. It's, I call it like making clay. You just have to get this and like lump out. Yes. And then once it's out, then you have something to play with. And then it's much more like, oh, and that's when things really start snapping. And so I think there's this idea that novel writing is this beautiful creative process and you just sit there and receive the muse, but you don't. You do the hard, painful work. And sometimes, as with If I Stay, the muse and the flow state comes very early on. Sometimes it comes much, much later. Sometimes it's like in your second or third revision where all of a sudden you just realize like, oh, that's how it's supposed to work. And then it just like comes out of you, but it's because you've done the work.
Yeah, I agree. I wrote a novel for my thesis in my undergrad. And I remember sitting and I was just like, I just have to get this out. Like, it just has to come out. If it's bad, it's bad. I'm going to fix it later. But like, I have this vision in my head and I just have to somehow get it onto some type of paper. Anytime.
It's been a real problem for me, a process to that whole accepting that it's going to be bad. You know, another editor, a friend of mine's like, I will fix it in post. It's true. Like it will come together. You have to have that faith. And I know that can be hard if you're writing your first novel or your fifth novel, but like it will come together. And some of my novels have sat on my hard drive for a couple years or longer before I've returned to them and had the distance and the desire to sort of figure out how, but they always do. They always do come together, but almost never on the first draft. I think we all get one miracle book. And after that, just count yourself lucky if you get any more.
So how do you, this is a writerly question for you. How, when you're going through revisions, I'm finding it very difficult to keep everything that I wrote previously, like at the end of the book in my head, as I'm editing the beginning of the book, do you make like little notes in your, I have my like copy printed out and I'm like flagging things. But then I'm like, what did I make this random character's eye color in the beginning? And now, you know,
I am glad to hear you say that. I just thought it was the fact that I'm middle-aged. Like and when you're doing multiple drafts and I'm like, I put things in overflow files, I move this, I'm like, what's in there? So yeah, I can't keep track. It's okay. Really hard. I have started writing in Scrivener sort of against my will in the beginning, but now I see the point of it. It really does help you break it down into individual components. And it's always a big moment for me when I get to flow something from Scrivener into Microsoft Word, where I'm so much more comfortable writing because I've done it for years. But, you know, I think what you're going to do is you're going to have discrepancies or you're going to have repetitions. You're going to have an idea that you have in chapter 7 and you repeat in chapter 19 and again in chapter 64. And when you revise, you're going to be like, okay, it's best here. So it comes down to revision, and then mistakes will make it through. And if you're professionally published or have friend readers, like they will flag things for you. But I'm telling you, I've noticed things in my novels that I'm just like, oh my God, that doesn't make any sense there. And luckily most readers don't read it like that. But I think there's no way, because we're humans and we're not machines. And so there you go. And it's also part of the magic is that we have these crazy minds and sometimes they don't catch things like that. But usually, hopefully between your readers and your editors, it gets caught.
Yeah, that's good to know, because I was editing and I was just like, how do I keep this all in my brain, all these people and what they look like and everything?
I mean, I think there are tools. Scrivener has so many tools that I don't use where you can have character notes and this and that. But then I have to remember where I put the character notes.
Yeah, I had just started getting into Scrivener too, because I wrote just in like a massive Word document. And I was like, maybe I need to be better organized. And
I think it's really helpful for books that are, that have somewhat interesting structures. Like if you have a dual POV or something like that, it's helpful. But even something I'm working on right now, which is just straightforward third person POV, it helps for me to sort of see like, oh, I've just had three scenes in a row that are at like the same setting or that feel similar. So it helps you to kind of pace, and you can kind of look down on it. It's incredibly helpful. I just finished reading The Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead, and I was reading her acknowledgments. All writers read the acknowledgments, and she thanked Scrivener. And I could totally see why, because that book was very, very structurally complex. Mm-hmm. And I could see where that would have been so helpful.
And you write mostly realistic fiction, right? Have you done more? Why are you called to that genre?
Well, I should say this as we're about to go out with something that is not realistic fiction at all, but it's mostly like, those are the stories that drive me. I find this world very, very fascinating as is. And I find, the complications and nuance in the realistic world, it's mostly what I like to read. I just think it's a matter of taste. I do love that fantasy is such a wonderful space to explore issues that are happening in the world that might alienate or trigger people in some, if you were doing it in the realistic world. Mm-hmm. Fantasy allows you that veil. But for just that reason, I prefer to write and read realistic, because I don't want any veil between it. I want to sort of really jump into how it is. And I have a hard enough time making sense of this world without creating a fantasy one. That said, when I did write this thing that was in a completely different world, I enjoyed it a lot. So,
what were some of the hardest scenes to write in any of your books, and why were they difficult?
So in If I Stay, an emotionally hard scene as opposed to a technically hard scene was the scene, and I did it in a revision when I went back, and so it's just the scene where Mia is trying at the accident scene, is like pinching herself, trying to get herself to wake up. And I felt such love for this character at this point. I mean, she felt like a child of mine. Mm-hmm. That I felt such horror for what I knew I was about to put her through. And so when I wrote that scene, it was just that moment of like horror recognition, like make it stop. It just killed me. I started bawling. Like with Just One Day, I would say the entire Paris section was really hard to write, because again, you want to get the joy of this city, mm-hmm. and the excitement of falling in love, but both characters who are concealing themselves. So the pacing of that, because it's, the love at first sight in 24 hours, you want that to feel real.
Yeah.
And you want it to like have that like fluttery feeling, building of tension. So that I remember really, really not liking that first section a lot, and kind of going back, and I was unable to really move ahead with the rest of the book. I thought, oh, I'll just write the rest of the bit, like the year after she meets him, and go back. But I couldn't, because I needed to know what parts of herself she had discovered that day that she would try and find and make permanent during the year. So that was really, I remember spending a lot of time on the first 100 pages of that book.
Yeah. In Just One Day, there's a lot of Shakespeare references, and a lot of the story kind of takes a little bit of inspiration from different Shakespearean plays. Why were you drawn to Shakespeare?
I just am. I have, it's another motif and a new thing. I think because the thing about Shakespeare, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, is it gets at that, those sort of immediacy feels. Mm-hmm. And I know that can be really hard to say to people who have not really experienced good Shakespeare. And, you know, there's no magic to it. It's not like I am so attuned in Old English that I understand everything that's going on. Nobody understands what's going on because the language is, but there's something that happens when you see a good Shakespearean production where it's almost like your ear attuning to a foreign dialect and then it clicks. And I've gone to some where I just am so deeply invested, and it blows my mind that so many hundreds of years later, we still are studying these plays. We are still performing these plays. So that's really what it is. Like, what is there? What deep, resonant human emotion are these plays getting at that makes them so relevant and resonant centuries later?
Yeah. And I loved how you included that in Just One Day, like when Allison realizes that as she's watching the play in Stratford upon Avon, it's like, this is so different. And then when she's in her class and he's saying, you know, you have to listen to Shakespeare. It's not about sitting alone reading Shakespeare. And one of the things in YA like scholarship is talking about using some of these books as a bridge for high school students to kind of better understand the classics. And I couldn't help but wonder, do you think that Just One Day could be used as a bridge to some of the Shakespearean texts that Allison and Willem talk about?
For sure. And there's so many books that, you know, have Shakespeare in them or retelling of Shakespeare. So I think, you know, yes, take advantage of that, because something that I find frustrating is that sometimes in education, we assume if something is inaccessible and difficult, that it is worthy. And I think it is the opposite. You want to find a portal through which somebody can do the hard work of understanding and untangling the Shakespeare and not have it feel like a chore. Yes. And why trying to find places of residence and, you know, things that you can connect to your life now, why that is seen as like some kind of like a crutch or a shortcut. Mm-hmm. It bewilders me. Like, you want people to be firing intellectually and emotionally. These are not separate entities. If you can bring them together, they only amplify each other.
Exactly. And there's so much richness just in young adult texts alone. And it always baffles me when I talk to some of my professors or even like my high school teachers, and there isn't that like want to teach these texts because they do feel like inaccessibility changes the worthiness of it. And I think that finally, I have talked to some scholars, we're getting to the point where that is changing and they're noticing how much engagement these students have with texts because they love them. And when you love something, you want to really dig into it and talk about it. And that's where like the academia comes in. That's where you get people who have interesting ideas because they want to talk about it. And that's talking is when you get those ideas. It's exciting to see.
I agree. And I always think about how Charles Dickens is such a staple of high school literature classes, and students don't love him. Mm-hmm. And during his time, he was an incredibly popular, accessible writer. It's written in a style that is antiquated, is hard to kind of breach without, you know, real help. And why are we doing that? Like, it's great to do that if you want to, but when we're trying to get people to look at narrative work and all the different levels it operates on and untangle it that way, like, why have something that is so much work for them to even read and find interesting? You know, I think there's certain novels, other novels that, you know, like the Jane Austen novels and Jane Eyre, one of my favorites growing up, like those ones have managed like Shakespeare, mm-hmm. even in spite of like, you know, language that is not, you know, super modern, to feel relevant and resonant. So great, teach those, but don't teach things just because the language is antiquated. It's just this idea that everybody decides on that this is canon. And obviously, thank goodness, that is being challenged on so many different levels about whose stories we're reading and talking about. And there's so much amazing contemporary stuff that's being published these days that wouldn't have been published 20, 30 years ago. So I hope that people are broadening their mind of like what constitutes something worthy of being taught.
Absolutely. And Charles Dickens, it's funny you mentioned that because I had one English teacher in high school and I went to a very small school. And so we had the same teachers like 2 out of the 4 years we were there. And he loved Charles Dickens and all he wanted to do was have us read Charles Dickens. And I remember I was like, I can't understand this. I'm so confused. And he was just kind of like, why are you confused about it? And wasn't actually teaching what was going on. And then I went to a book talk. This was not all that long ago with Cassandra Clare. And she was retelling Great Expectations in like one of her fantasy worlds in the last hours. And I was reading those books and I was just like, wow, it's all kind of clicking now. I understand maybe what Charles Dickens was saying. Whereas before I had absolutely no idea what was going on. And all I needed was a world that was actually engaging and immersing me to be like, yes, these themes make sense. This all makes sense. And it finally came together. So it just to that point is so true.
Yeah. So imagine if you had been taught the Cassandra Clare alongside Great Expectations. I think there's so many great retellings. Like it just makes sense to do that and to talk about like where it's been updated and why.
And you mentioned the canon. If you could include some YA books in the canon, either from contemporary books or classics, what would you include in that young adult canon?
Oh boy, that's a tough one. You know, I think I would want to include some sort of classics like The Hate U Give. I would want to have like one of like David Levithan's Boy Meets Boy, just because like that so helped to change the world for queer lit.
Yeah.
You know, I think I would want to have a lot of some contemporary stuff. Like I think, you know, you would need to have The Hate U Give or something like that, because it's just, again, that book has it changed things.
Definitely.
So I think I would want books, you know, across the board that sort of challenged the time and the paradigm, and books that also challenge your idea of what YA literature should be.
Absolutely. What are some of your favorite YA books?
Let's see. It's also a tough one. I have to like think of this. I always go back to E. Lockhart's a good friend of mine, and I love We Were Liars and the prequel. But The Disreputable History of Frankie Landau Banks is one of my favorite YA books. I love Angie Thomas. I love Hate U Give and Concrete Rose. I thought they were both just super fantastic. Melina Marchetta, the Australian author, I have reread her books. I think her most well-known is On the Jellicoe Road, or Jellicoe Road Here.
Oh, yes, On the Jellicoe Road.
So she has that. She has Saving Francesca and The Piper's Son. Like, those are three of my favorite YA books of all times. And I have gone back to them over and over again. Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. I don't know if that's YA or middle grade or adult, but I think that's something that every time I go into, I see something new. There's just so many. I can't even tell you. I'm trying to think like through the years, all these books that I have loved so much. Nina LaCour, We Are Okay.
Yes.
Anything Jani Nelson, anything Jason Reynolds, anything Danielle Clayton. There's just so much great stuff.
There are. And there's so many coming out too. Every time I am going through the new releases, I'm like, wow, they're just amazing books all the time.
Oh, I have to say something. This is YA and it's nonfiction, but Elliot Schreffer's Queer Ducks, which I just finished listening to, is fantastic and delightful and informative. And it's about sort of how we have imposed a sort of binary, straight binary onto animal sexuality as a way to show that heterosexuality and cisgenderedness is the norm. And he blows that up in the most entertaining of ways.
Interesting. And it's a nonfiction YA?
It's nonfiction YA. It's called Queer Ducks. Okay. Yeah. I loved it. Yeah.
So I have a question circling back to your books about the role of the parents in If I Stay. I reread this and I was moved by Mia's relationship with her mother and her father, and how different it is from a lot of the parental relationships that I've seen in other YA books, where the parents are either not present or they're kind of like an obstacle. Whereas with Mia, they are like a huge part of her world. They're her friends. I love the scene. I cry when she's talking with her mother over the dishes after Adam. And it reminds me of my mother and I, and it just, it brings tears to my eyes every time. So why did you want to write this kind of parental relationship here?
Maybe because I have too big of an ego. I was a parent myself when I wrote If I Stay. My daughter was three, my oldest daughter, who's now, you know, just graduated high school. And I am not willing to have the parents be just these like background figures. Now, in If I Stay, it's a very wonderful and loving relationship, because when you have death as the antagonist, you don't really need anybody to be antagonistic. Yeah. In Just One Day and Just One Year, like, there definitely are parental, there are parents there that are, that it's a more complicated relationship. But whether you have a great relationship with your parents or not, generally speaking, they are a major force in your life as an adolescent. So to leave them out of YA just seems completely wrong. And I understand why. It's the same reason, like, you often see parents killed off in Disney movies or in you know, in middle grade. It's because if you want young people to have agency, you need the parents out of the way. Otherwise, they can't really have an adventure because there's a curfew and there's somebody, you know, making sure that they're doing their homework and eating their vegetables. But that said, parents are major forces in all of my books. And it was really nice to write a middle grade where I once again felt like the adults in it were just such loving forces. I mean, they're not a traditional family, but there's like a mother and there's an upstairs neighbor and a downstairs, like a found family. And these adults are just wonderful and loving, as, you know, I hope the adults are in young people's lives. So I really like it when parents are in YA because I think it's kind of realistic. And that relationship to me is always very interesting. And I like to see parents. And again, this goes back to my ego, is like, once I become a mother, I don't want to just be mom. I still have, I'm still Gail. So I want to see parents that are doing parental things, but also are their own people and not just this kind of sitcom version of mom and dad. Absolutely. Also, mom and dad is a very specific kind of family structure that is also antiquated. So I like seeing like mom and gay uncle or, you know, two moms or single mom or single dad, because there's all different ways to create family.
Exactly. There's so many different types of family. And I love how that's been reflected so much more, because it's just important to see, especially when you're a young person and your family looks a little bit different, to see it reflected in books is incredible. And let's see, what else? I have so many things I want to talk to you about. You teach writing online. What drove you to want to teach writing? What's some advice you would give to young writers?
I taught writing on and off sort of throughout my career, and I find it like incredibly humbling and incredibly gratifying. And I learn a lot about my own writing when I'm teaching other people. So it's really helpful. You know, I think I have all kinds of like different things. And I guess what I really, it boils down to is sort of lean into your voice, into your story and the story you have to tell. Here, I'm going to move into the shade. I think, you know, when you're younger, you think, oh, I want to be this, I want to be that. It's great. Try on all those different voices. Like, you know, write a book in the style of, you know, Cassie Clare or Erin Entrada. Like, just try it all out and you'll find your voice. But I think it can be overwhelming to think, what do I have to offer? And the thing you have to offer is that you have a unique set of experiences in the way that you look at the world. And nobody is going to tell a story the way you are because of that. So don't run away from that. That is your superpower.
Yeah.
And so to find the stories that really allow you to put your uniqueness onto a page, even if you're writing about, you know, a dystopian futuristic society or space wars, whatever, it's still you and your particular set of interests and viewpoints and perspectives. So I think that is kind of the meta. Obviously, we've talked a lot about revising and just doing the work, right? Like, you just, if everybody worries, it's like, oh, I've hit a snag at my midway point. Like, hi, everybody does. Mm-hmm. There's no secret recipe. other than just working through it and writing a shitty first draft with a spongy middle and fixing it in post.
Yeah.
I also think writing can be incredibly solitary. And lately I've been doing more work where it's collaborative, mm-hmm. and that is not really, you know, you might write a novel with somebody, but it's a fairly solitary experience. So I think it can be incredibly helpful to have a crit group or readers or just people that you can like talk out your head with, because that's hugely important. Some other things that I think are important is to read your work out loud. And I think that when I was younger and I was made to memorize poetry, that actually gave me an ear for cadence and rhythm that I internalized. So read poetry out loud in front of your mirror and read your work out loud. So there's some advice right there. And I think on Skillshare, I think the class is really just about how to figure out what you want to write about, like how to come up with a framework for a novel.
Reading out loud. I'm so happy you mentioned that, because I remember my first fiction workshop in undergrad. He had my teacher, who I adore now. He's become a big mentor for me. He had us bring in two chapters of the piece we were working on and then sat us all down. He was like, okay, and now we're reading out loud to one another. And I remember I just like was like, no, I can't do it. And now I read everything out loud. It truly is a huge game changer to hear it.
Yes.
And yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, I think each different way of revising, you get different things. But when you read out loud, first of all, the things that you're like, that's fine. It's okay. It doesn't make me sick. Like, you cannot avoid the clankers, the things that feel inauthentic. Like, at least when I read them out loud, it's just like, it's a full body reaction. Mm-hmm. So I just cut. And, you know, you realize like how to make a sentence more rhythmic. And even though your readers are not going to be reading out loud, presumably, mm-hmm. There is something to that rhythm that is going to enhance the reading experience. So there's just so many good reasons to do it. It helps you find things like echoes. It helps. I think it's a different part of your brain that you're using, and particularly when you're writing and revising. For me, I'm the queen of the typo, because visually I can't see them after a certain point. Like, I go for sentences so many times, I can't see it. So being able to hear it, you know, it's a different way of processing what you've written and revising.
Yeah, your eyes just start to glaze over and fill in like, oh yeah, like it would be that, but then it's not actually read out loud. That's when you know it isn't that wrong.
Yeah.
When you go about writing what young adult versus middle grade, is there a big difference in how you go about or changing your voice, obviously, but what do you think?
In terms of like the process, it's the same, but the mm-hmm. voice definitely changes. I mean, I think it's about finding the voice every time, but in the middle grade with Frankie and Bug, it took me a really long time to find Bug's voice. Mm-hmm. And I was definitely a third person voice, because I wanted that distance a little bit, right? I didn't want the 10-year-old to completely have control of the story. But so it was very helpful to do that. And the same with when I'm writing adult fiction, it's always been in the third person, because I don't know, there's just that need for that remove. But other than that, and other than the kind of finding of the voice, I think they're the same, you know, with middle grade, definitely. The middle grade that I wrote was, you know, it was historical, set in the 80s. And so part of the reason for doing that is I wanted young people to see just how quickly some things could change and how intractable other problems remained. So you're writing about the 80s when the culture was very different, but you have to have a sensitivity for today's readers. Mm-hmm. So bridging that gap was important. And just, I always assume the most of my reader, I assume that they can handle what I'm throwing at them. And if they can't, they either won't internalize it, it'll just go right over their head, or they'll put the book down or not pick it up in the first place. Mm-hmm. So there's that. Like, people ask, oh, do you take things out or do you hold back? And I do not.
Mm-hmm. You talk about using your own personal experience and putting your voice into your characters. Do you find that there are certain parts in your books where like you feel yourself, your younger self, or maybe your adult self, like really reflected in certain moments?
It's so hodgepodge. Like, you know, to go back to Mia, when I first started writing her, I was like, where is this voice coming from? She's more mature than like 30 something me that who was writing her. Yeah. So it's not like, oh, that's my voice, but you know, stories make it through. Sometimes it's just straight lifted from my life. A friend of mine just read Frankie and Bug and said, oh my goodness, I could see you in Bug. And I, you know, that made me laugh. But I don't know that there's something, it's not as straightforward as that. I just think it's impossible not to write a character that has some element of you. And this is true for the villains too. Like, you are writing these people. Mm-hmm. They have you in them.
Yeah.
Your DNA is their DNA.
That's so true. And it's very hard. I was talking about creative nonfiction with my high school class. And I was saying, you know, yes, there's creative nonfiction where you can write a memoir, you can do a more journalistic piece. And I said, you know, I think, however, that sometimes like your creative nonfiction makes your way into your fiction because you're taking a lot of what you've experienced in your life and you might just be like changing a few details and maybe fictionalizing it for a different character. But that's where you get that like raw realness. Like someone can feel it because you're in it and you're a human and you're there in the writing. So yeah, I think that's what makes for these amazing books.
My first book was nonfiction. It was a travel memoir. And I often say that it was my least honest book. And it's not because like I fabricated anything. Yeah. It's just without the veil of fiction. I really kind of held back. It was much harder. I really believe that adage, fiction is the lie that tells the truth. Mm-hmm. And one of the things when I'm giving a writing workshop, I will tell people there's ways to take these intense personal experiences of your life. And if you want to straight up fictionalize it, great. Yeah. But there's another way, and I call it sort of writing through the back door. You really kind of want to hone in on the emotional experience and see if you can find a different fictional story that taps into that, but at enough of a remove that you really can fully explore it with all honesty, but not sort of feel like you are revealing too much of yourself or more than you want to. So, you know, in the case of If I Stay, it was fairly close to a real event where I lost four friends in a car accident, much like the one Mia's family is in. And like, you know, the mom and the dad and Teddy were basically those characters brought to life. But Mia was fully fictional. Adam was fully fictional. The rest of the world was. And, you know, it allowed me to explore that question that I had since my friends died, because the little boy lived longer. He eventually died too, but I had always had this vision of him on this medical chopper with the rest of his family gone. And I wondered, like, did he know that they were all gone and did he choose to go with them? And so this is even before I was a novelist, like 7 or 8 years later, that's where Mia came from. So telling her story allowed me to kind of excavate that mystery for myself and to really be with my friends again. Like, they came back to me so vividly writing that book. So, you know, other books like Just One Day, I thought, oh, you know, what am I writing about now? And I realized after the fact, it was a time in my life where I was figuring out how to set boundaries for myself. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Allison is doing. And of course, travel was hugely important to me in a very different way than it was. I was very different from Allison. Anyhow, it allowed me to kind of explore that. And a lot of times I don't fully get what I'm writing about until after, like with I Was Here. It was after I was like, oh, this is about somebody who has given away all their power. And this is what happens when she takes it back.
Yeah. Yeah. My other question is, Adam and Willem and the romantic relationships that you create in like We Are Inevitable, why do you think it's important to have those romantic relationships present in young adult books?
You know, I think that they amplify what else is going on. So, you know, If I Stay in Just One Day, definitely have, you know, incredible romantic relationships, but they're not the point of the story. Yeah, so I feel like they're an additive to it, and it really ups the stakes. Like, you know, those, when you fall in love, it really changes things. Although, like, I feel like the older I get, the less like the true love stories have become. You know, with We Are Inevitable, there is a love story with Hannah, but I would say the primary love story is the bromance between Aaron and Chad.
Yeah.
And I think that's because I'm increasingly aware of just how important your friendships are, mm-hmm. and how that line that we create between like sexual and romantic love and friendship love is kind of ridiculous, because mm-hmm. you can have these very, very intimate relationships. And that's what I'm interested in exploring, is intimate relationships, no matter what form they take.
Yeah. I loved, especially in Just One Day, when I was rereading it, the relationship between Dee and Allison.
I love Dee.
Like progresses, and you just see how close they become. And I loved too that they had a fight too in the middle of it, where they were not talking to one another, because I was like, this is real. Like, you get in these modes with your best friend, and then all of a sudden, like, you're crying in the bathroom and they're there and they're like, I'm here, like, it's over, like, we're together again, and that's it. Yeah. And that felt very, very real, and you could feel the love between them in the same way that you can feel, you know, romantic love. Of course, that's a bit different, but that emotional power is still so palpable and so present.
Thank you. No, I sometimes say, like, what character would you want to spend time with? And for a long time, it was Dee. Dee's got no time for bullshit. And yet is a complete, I think, you know, we talk a lot now about the different ways we perform gender and race and class. But when I wrote that in 2012, it was like not part of the conversation. And there was Dee, who is just completely fucking with people by leaning into their expectations of him and like tweaking. It was hilarious. I loved that. And I also figured, you know, given growing up going to, as a, you know, scholarship student in primarily white institutions and being sort of queer in a gender performative way, that in 2012, 2013 was not as sort of accepted as it is now, even though it's more accepted in some places as it is now. I loved the way Dee did that. So, you know, him and Allison, it was a fun friendship to write.
Yeah, I loved reading that. So I guess my final question is, if you could pick one young adult book to read for the rest of your life, which one would it be and why?
Oh, that is such a hard question. All right, I'm going to have to think on that for a minute. It's like, I mean, I reread those Melina Marquettas so many times, but I haven't read them in years. Young adult book to reread for the rest of my life. I think I'll have to go back to the Melina Marquettas, just because I have a history of already rereading them, and I found such new things each time I did. But, you know, I also want to say Barkeeper's Daughter. Like, I feel like a book like that, I could reread a bunch, just because it's a world. Same with Everything Sad is Untrue. Mm-hmm. I know that the book is getting to me when I'm Googling locations from the book.
Yes.
Because it's opening me up to a world that I haven't seen before. I also feel like I could just reread like Heartstopper over and over again, because it's just so delightful and fun and happy. But I feel like it would only take me half an hour. So
yeah, you feel good when you're reading it. Sometimes that's nice too.
Yeah, exactly. So I think things like that, where I can just go kind of layers into layers, worlds into worlds.
Yeah. So like I said, that was such an amazing interview. Gail has so many great pieces of advice for writers. She makes so many great points about the importance of reading YA books and what they can do not only for a young audience, but also for adults. And I think that that's really what we're trying to show here, that young adult books are valid no matter who is reading them, in what setting, and there's just so much work that goes into these books. And you can really tell when you talk to the authors that their whole heart and soul is in these. And I love talking with her. And I am excited to continue talking to young adult authors. So join me next time. See you then. Bye-bye.